Hey, you listeners, as you guys will be able to tell from this episode was recorded a little while ago. This was recorded the week of the 30th when I went out of town, so that week after Thanksgiving week. I did not get around to editing it, and it just kind of dragged on, and I've been very busy with my SRA duties, but I did go ahead and get it done and finished. I'm releasing it tonight, and then you can also expect the other regular episode to release tonight as well after this one. So, enjoy! Hello and welcome to the SRA Podcast. This is episode 18, and we are back after another break for the Thanksgiving holiday. We were out and about, as it were, you know, seeing family, doing things, being busy. As some of you might have heard over the Thanksgiving holiday, on Thanksgiving Day itself, the SRA achieved 1,000 dues-paying members. So we were very excited to hear that, and just great, great show of support. Joining me once again is, of course, the regular, I don't know, Faye. It's Faye. It's always Faye. That's...
Hi, everybody. You know, Alex has tried, but he just can't get rid of me.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when those chapel bucks finally start pouring in. So, but let us not get too carried away on this episode. This is going to be an interesting episode. I'm probably going to be editing this one real quick, or maybe I'll shunt it off to Faye and she can take a hack at it. That I will actually be. At the time of this episode's release, I will be in Colorado Springs. We are recording this the night before because when we tried to record Wednesday, we recorded a great podcast. It was not good for this kind of podcast. And I will be at the Marxist Center. So I will be attending, representing the SRA and the Central Committee over there. And we will be, you know, seeing what the Marxist Center is up to. We were invited to come attend, and I'm really excited to see. We've got folks from Nebraska and Colorado coming out from our SRA chapters in Omaha, and then the Front Range chapter over there in Colorado. So it will be a great time, I'm sure. I'll meet plenty of people, and definitely anyone who wants to come talk to me, I'm sure I will be available and mingling, as it were. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that'll be good. And who knows, there might be a very special episode coming out of that with a very special someone, but we'll have to see how that works out. So, for your listening pleasure right now, though, we have a few stories. Making its regular return, as always, is the Elon Musk segment. This time, apparently, I might have gotten my facts mixed up, but it sounds like Elon Musk dug a tunnel underneath Faye's house and subsumed it. So I'm sure she has an interesting tale from that.
Yes, I'm actually reporting from underground right now, and the Hyperloop cars are zipping right past my head. But in all seriousness, so Elon Musk's appropriately named Boring Company, his far-fetched sort of urban transportation boondoggle, ran into a snag recently. They were hoping to create a essentially it's a, Musk apparently has been in LA enough to realize that we have a massive traffic problem. You know, I'm out here in the San Gabriel Valley, you know, sort of east of East LA. And, you know, during rush hour traffic, getting to or from downtown from my location can take 2, 3, 3.5 hours just to travel 50 miles. You know, getting, you know, traveling up and down the 405, you know, up and down the west side of LA, you know, it turns into a parking lot. It takes hours and hours to get anywhere. Musk apparently has gotten tired of that traffic, and he's been proposing a, it's hard to describe it. It's not a subway. It's not a, basically he wants to create a system where you drive into a little elevator, which drops your car underground onto a sled, and then that sled is then electromagnetically propelled underground, underneath the city, to another station, and then the elevator lifts your car up, and then you drive back onto the roads. And he's pitching this as a way of solving LA's traffic problem. This is stupid for so many reasons. It's sort of an issue of anyone who's sort of familiar with like computer engineering will be familiar with the difference between latency and bandwidth. You know, having this sort of underground sled system, you know, you can get one car from one place to another very quickly, but you're only going to be transporting one or two cars at a time, you know, versus the freeway system where you are able to transport hundreds of thousands, millions of vehicles at a time. Basically, Musk's system, which he has proposed, is such a low bandwidth system that it would not make any measurable difference on LA's traffic in any way at all, and would simply be a way for rich fuckers like Elon Musk to get a zippy ride across town while everyone else is stuck on the freeway. So, you know, it's a stupid, stupid plan. It's a ridiculously expensive infrastructure project. Even though the Boring Company is supposed to reduce the cost of creating tunnel systems, it's still, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions, for a long tunnel, just to allow a few rich people to get, you know, to skip waiting on the 405 with the rest of us. But, fortunately, there was some neighborhood reaction to this. Los Angeles has a very strong, you know, NIMBY culture, not in my backyard. And for once, it did a good thing. And a bunch of local neighborhoods kicked up enough of a fuss that Elon Musk had to cancel his plan to build one of these tunnel stations off of Sepulveda Boulevard in downtown LA. However, he still has an alternate plan to create a tunnel system between the Los Angeles Metro's Red Line and Dodger Stadium. So basically a way to transport rich people between Hollywood or possibly downtown LA and the Dodgers, so that they can go and they can watch their, you know, favorite game of sports ball, while everyone else has to deal with parking and has to deal with everything else. So, I mean, this isn't like the worst thing in the world. This isn't like hurting tons of people, but it's still sort of just, you know, an example of the sort of, I guess like Zizek would call it liberal communism, that you're trying to like make these proposals, this sort of Silicon Valley, you know, techno-futurism with bourgeois characteristics, where they want to try to create this, you know, beautiful, perfect vision of the future, but only for the ultra-rich. And that's basically what this tunnel project is. And they're trying to get public funding for it, and they're trying to get LA to waive a bunch of local laws and give them permits, and all this other stuff. And yeah, it's just a waste. This isn't going to be used by anyone except for a handful of extremely rich people. And I'm angry about it.
Honestly, thinking about this, I have pictures in my head. You know, I understand it's not how it works, but I'm kind of imagining like in the OG Gundam, where, you know, the Gundams get loaded up into the rail guns on the front of the ships and just get shot out. I'm just imagining that's how that works.
No, that's literally basically how it works. It's just that in a long track in a tunnel underground. And it transports one or two cars at a time, or maybe like 20 people.
Fantabulous. Yeah, see, that's the sort of visionary thinking that we can expect out of Elon Musk, who has apparently done the ever fruitful adventure of combining sleeping pills with uppers. So remember, never combine downers with uppers. That's not how you get good results. So is my take on that. It sucks that, you know, he's probably going to, well, actually, you know, looking at this, it seems like, you know, LA pushed back on it pretty decently, and maybe he won't get his way for once. And I don't know, it looks like he might also be appealing to the state government to, you know, show out the money and waive the rules for him. So I don't know if that's going to be a profitable thing for him or not, but seems like there's better ways that it maybe could be done.
There's a few. How about more light rail? you know, expand our public transit that everyone can afford and that will move more than one person at a time. Just a crazy thought.
Yeah, yeah, that would be an option for sure of, you know, building trains. You know, we've gotten pretty good at building trains. Trains are tried and true technology, so that's always an option. And maybe also, I feel like one thing that California in particular suffers from, that like the urban sprawl is just too sprawly.
Oh, it's awful. It's everything is so far apart and it takes so long to get anywhere. You know, we're organizing the LA chapter of the SRA down here. And we had a great range day just this last Sunday. You know, great range day, 20 people out on public land, you know, shot some really cool guns. Someone had a nice FAL that they managed to make California legal. It was a great time. But we had people, you know, we had people who took 3 hours just to get to like, just to get to like the meetup point before going to the range, which was, you know, hours away from that. So it's, you know, LA is such a huge city. It takes hours to get anywhere in it. You know, it's Los Angeles could almost, Los Angeles County could almost be its own state in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things I look at and, you know, looking at aerial photographs, and I mean, just looking at Google Maps too, like, you know, there's ways to manage the urban sprawl. And like, I feel like, especially here in like Kansas, you know, Wichita, by no means a huge city. It's still in the top 50, but that's not saying too much. You can still get around in the Wichita metro 45 minutes to the outskirts of the metro anywhere you are, basically. And I think a lot of that is not only the fact that we have surprisingly good highway system, but also the fact that, like, the city is laid out in a very nice grid-like fashion. And like, grids, they aren't pretty, but they're efficient. Like, having evenly spaced roads and evenly spaced artery roads and evenly spaced highways, it's not pretty, but it's efficient. And that's how you keep the urban sprawl under control. But then you look at like the suburbs I see in these huge metropolitan areas, and they just got snaky roads. Like, these roads just snake around everywhere. And, you know, and for some places, I understand why that's the case. Like, when I was driving for Georgia, you know, those roads snake all over the place. And I get it, because those roads are back hundreds of years ago. Those roads were laid down and the initial ways were found. And that was before we had, you know, modern earth-moving equipment. So that's just a historical holdover. But with California, and California was settled after we figured out how to work dynamite. And I just, it's just because some urban planner decided that, well, I don't like straight lines. Straight lines are boring. So I'm going to make this nice fancy curve, which just kills traffic.
In LA, we've gotten good at making grids. Most of our wavy roads are wavy because they're up in the hills or they're up in the mountains or something. The issue is just low density. We have so much, you know, spread out single family housing. We have so much low density commercial development. We have so many wide open parking lots just, and, you know, spread out, you know, freeways. Just the land use is so inefficient out here. But, you know, it keeps developing at a rapid pace. I've seen, there's a community to my southeast called Chino Hills, and that community has been spreading. It's very, like, affluent. They've been spreading to the southeast, you know, through the hills, and they're, you know, it's insane how an area that I was able to, like, go and hike in 5 years ago is now completely paved over with houses and apartment complexes. And all of the apartment complexes charge $1,500 for a one bedroom. And all of these people just commute into Orange County, or they commute into LA, and, you know, they have all this space taken up by their cars, and then they drive their cars on the freeways downtown, and it adds to the traffic, and it adds to the pollution, and it adds to the smog. And, you know, they're building all these places in areas that are fire prone, right next to, you know, sagebrush, you know, chaparral sort of environments. And eventually the whole place is going to go up in flames. California is not well planned. We have figured out grids, but in terms of land use and density, it's a disaster. But anyway,
pretty much.
Speaking of disasters.
Yeah. So, you know, the elections happened, and I don't know. I can barely muster the strength at this point that the Democrats, they just, if, you know, my dad used to tell me that the Republicans are a party that tries to find ways to lose. And if that's the case, then the Democrats have decided that if the Republicans can lose real good, that they're just going to lose even harder. And they're just going to try their darndest to make sure they never get elected again. And basically, it's beyond parody at this point. It's literally beyond parody that Chuck Schumer went up in the Senate and was like, so Trump wanted $5 billion for his border security stuff. The wall. Build the wall. Build the wall is what they keep telling us. And instead of $5 billion, Chuck Schumer said that he was only going to do $1.3 billion and that he wasn't going to negotiate in public, but he was going to do $1.3 billion instead of the $5 billion. Not that the wall isn't going to get built, but just that he's only going to give him $1.3 billion instead of $5 billion to do it.
$0?
Yeah. So how about Chuck Schumer goes and grows a spine and stands up to Trump because, you know, he's the minority leader. Like, now that the filibuster is gone in the Senate, now that we can just pass whatever we want, because who cares about obtaining more consensus? Both parties lost any semblance of that they might have had in the past where, you know, we had the filibuster and there was some kind of, you know, agreement in place that, hey, maybe if there's really staunch disapproval of something, then maybe we should take a step back. And yes, it's the sort of thing that gets exploited, because of course it gets exploited. But at the same time, trying to obtain more consensus on an issue usually is for the better. Now, of course, that does depend on who you're getting the consensus from. I mean, this is not necessarily a good statistical average of the population to try to get a good barometer off of when you've got a bunch of rich white dudes in Congress, basically, and that's the barometer you're going to be going off of. But, you know, at least there was some semblance of that, some kind of facade, at least. And now that there isn't, well, what can you do as the minority party? You can't do shit. The only thing you can do is raise a gigantic fuss, and that's what they should be doing. They should be out there and saying, no, this is shitty and terrible, and why are you such a racist, and this is proto-fascism, very hardly even proto at this point.
Well, but the thing is that they have a majority now, or that they will at the beginning of the new year. They're going to have a majority. The issue is that the Democratic leadership is, they don't disagree with Trump. They don't disagree with Trump's policies, really. Some of the Democratic majority, the House and the Senate, the progressive part of the party, does disagree. But the centrists, the blue dogs, and these, you know, 70 and 80-year-old fossils in the leadership, they're totally fine with what Trump is doing in theory. They just don't want to see the open rhetoric, the open racism that he's dealing with. They, you know, they still want to restrict immigration. They still want to... And I just have to comment on this, because this is a story that I literally just found a little bit ago. The Intercept reported. So Nancy Pelosi became the new House Majority Leader, or, you know, she will become the new House Majority Leader. There was a small effort to resist her, mostly from blue dog centrists, but she won with a vast majority of the vote. However, the caucus chair position was a tight race between Barbara Lee, who's a very progressive, you know, African-American, you know, House representative. She is the only person to vote against the authorization of force for Afghanistan, and one of the only people to vote against the Iraq war. You know, she's not a socialist, she's not like a leftist, but she's one of the most progressive people in Congress. She ran for the House, you know, Majority Caucus Chair, which is a sort of leadership position that she was hoping to use as a stepping stone to get towards, to take a step towards possibly, you know, taking Nancy Pelosi's place in the future as the House Majority Leader. The issue was that Joe Crowley, the current caucus chair until the end of the year, sabotaged her campaign by spreading lies about her to other House members. Specifically, Joe Crowley, who is a, you know, blue dog centrist, coming from what should be a very liberal district, he was ousted by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and he's salty that he was replaced by this, you know, progressive socialist, you know, movement in the party. And so he decided to sabotage Barbara Lee by going around and telling other, you know, slightly more conservative caucus members that Barbara Lee had funded Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign, telling her that he had cut, that she had cut Alexandria a big check, and that therefore she was, you know, fighting against the party unity, and she shouldn't be in a leadership position because she's, you know, disruptive and destructive to the party's unity. The thing is, that was a lie. She didn't fund, Barbara Lee didn't fund Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign against Joe Crowley. She cut a $1,000 check, which is nothing, to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. 2 weeks after Joe Crowley's loss, she contributed to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's AOC's. She contributed to AOC's general election campaign against the Republican, who's a nobody that doesn't matter. Essentially, Joe Crowley went out and lied to other members of Congress to sabotage a progressive black woman running for a leadership position in the Democratic Party by implying that she was, you know, disruptive to the party leadership, which she is, because she's a woman of color with progressive ideals who's standing up to all these fucking old white dudes in suits who've been running this party, you know, for decades in their own interests. And so that really shows the sort of backbiting and the sort of politicking that the Democratic Party leadership gets up to, and the pettiness of them, that they're willing to, you know, sabotage other members of their party to, you know, just to prevent ideological change from within, even when that's something that they know that a lot of voters want. And it's just disgusting, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's one of those things that I've definitely heard plenty, you know, listening to my podcasts and reading news, that, like, just the leadership stuff in the Democratic Party, there's so much in there that's just an entrenchment, that you have these representatives who have been in there forever and have very little chances of actually getting ousted. Like, we think of the House, and we think of, well, doesn't the House switch over every couple of years? And yes and no, like, despite the fact that, yeah, every now and then we have, you know, a wave or something, this, at the same time, if you get your seat, you're probably going to keep it. Like, it's very hard to lose your seat as a congressperson unless you are in a very heavily contested district, of which there are very few that are around. That, I mean, the turnover rate of Congress is less than that of the old Supreme Soviet. It's a ridiculous number. I think it's like past 80% likelihood that once you're an incumbent, you stay an incumbent. And what this means is that you get entrenched into the party, and then you find your way into some sort of leadership role, and you stay in that leadership role until the day you retire or you die in the office. And that's usually, you know, how people do this sort of thing, is that if you're going to make a career, or if you're going to make a lifetime gig out of this, you just keep on winning elections, and you just keep on going back to Congress and collecting that nice congressperson salary, collecting all the checks that come in for donors and interest groups. You collect your nice pension, you collect your fully funded government health care. It's a pretty sweet gig once it's in there, and you're staying in this leadership position, which, by the way, leadership positions include extra pay, both from the Congress and from the party. So there's extra perks that come with those leadership positions, which makes people even less likely to want to step down from them and let somebody else take the reins. And you get these people that say, well, you know, all these young people, they gotta learn, and they gotta learn the ropes, and they gotta wait their turn. The problem is their turn, is going to be 30 years, because somebody gets elected in their 40s to 50s, and then they stick around, and then they live to be 90, because being a congressperson, kind of stressful, also kind of great. That it's a pretty sweet gig, that there's definitely a lot of stresses that go into it, but with all the benefits and perks of being entrenched into the party and being entrenched into DC politics grants you, if you're a serious career politician, and most people in these leadership positions are serious career politicians and not just, you know, the quote unquote citizen legislature types, where, you know, you come from a humble background, like AOC, perhaps. Like, that's something else that just rubs me the wrong way, is that, you know, you have all these quote-unquote conservative types that yearn for the day that, you know, this romantic idea that once upon a time, Congress, you know, Congress only met a couple times a year, and Congress people were all citizens of the day and esteemed individuals who, you know, took time out of their day to go up and deliberate on the matters of the land. And of course, that wasn't how things were. In colonial America, most states had it to where you could only vote if you had land. And certainly if you were going to be a representative, you had land and probably slaves and all these other things. And the citizens' legislature in that context didn't really exist. And more so, you know, in the modern day, you have AOC out there, and she's talking about how expensive DC rent is. And these assholes are just deceitful and liars and frauds, because they're out there. So she's making a comment, and, you know, I don't agree with everything AOC says. I don't think she always says the best of things, but she's still a very important step forward for us. She's still a good person. At least she isn't terrible like other people I could name. And she made a thing saying, look, I've got to go up for the next 3 months. I gotta survive 3 months without my job, because, you know, Congress doesn't get sworn in until the end of January. So she's a congressperson elect until then, a representative elect until she's sworn in. And in the meantime, she still has to go to DC. She's still got to be involved in DC politics. She's still got to go do party politics. So she's got to be in DC for the next 3 months after the election. And she's talking about, how am I going to afford rent? Because, you know, coming from a bartender salary, that's probably not enough to afford DC rent. And of course, these f-ing conservative pundits are out there going, just these vile people out there going, well, if you can't figure out how to budget on $172,000, which is what a congressperson makes in their salary, then how can you budget for the United States? It's like,
it's all in bad faith. You know, they keep veering back and forth between attacking her for being poor and attacking her for being supposedly rich. Like, one minute they're attacking her for, like, you know, you're too poor to afford rent and you don't know how to budget. Oh, but look, she has $7,000 in her savings account. Oh, she's like, how can you be poor if you have 7,000 whole dollars? Or like, oh, wow, look, she has a suit. That, oh, wow, that could have cost a whole $200, you know? Or, she wore a dress for this magazine shoot. Oh, wow, this was a designer dress. It must have cost thousands of dollars. Never mind that, you know, dresses for those sorts of, you know, photo ops are usually borrowed and not actually taken home by the people who wear them. And what it is that all of these attacks are purely in bad faith. And you know, if nothing else, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she has some questionable politics still in my mind, but she's still probably the most leftist person in Congress right now. And I have to say, it's really great seeing Fox News and all these conservative idiots completely lose their shit over the mildest social democratic proposals, and just losing their shit over the fact that there's a young, you know, woman of color in their ranks who's willing to stand up to the, you know, ruling ideology that they've been enforcing for decades. And I have to say, this isn't something that probably matters in the grand scheme of things, but AOC's Twitter game is on point. I mean, when it comes, you know, she knows how to land a good dunk, is what I'm saying here.
Yeah, she is a very good social media-er, and it's encouraging to see that. I think more politicians need to be better on social media. Now, of course, I don't know. I might have to retract that, considering. But at the same time, being good at social media, what I'm getting at here is Donald Trump, of course, very active on social media. I would not consider him good at it, though. Like, active, yes. Good, yeah. I'd rate his Twitter game a solid C.
Maybe a C+. He's good for a baby boomer.
I always forget that he's in his 70s. He's one of our oldest presidents now. I don't know when he beats Reagan. I don't know if he actually... I know him and Reagan were really close in age.
If he gets a second term, he'll out-age Reagan.
Yeah. I don't know. You know. This is... Well, and you know, it's this thing that we need some kind of good political presence out there right now, and just Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer just are nothing of that. And, like, obviously, fantastic. This is a leftist podcast. We're preaching to the choir right now. But at the same time, even if we don't have full-blown socialists in office trying to enact policies, like, we at least can have people that aren't completely terrible. And that's where we are. Pelosi has been a dead weight on the party for so long now. And just nobody... I mean, nobody's even challenging her this time. She's just going to be the Speaker of the House. Except that now some of the Blue Dog Democrats are threatening not to vote for her, at which point the Speaker of the House doesn't get selected. And we could end up in a situation that I believe has only happened 2 or 3 times in American history, where the Speaker of the House is of the minority party. It doesn't happen very much, but it does... I'm pretty sure it's happened before. I'm pretty sure I remember reading about when it's happened before, that every now and then, you know, that happens. And interestingly enough, what would be a great Hail Mary for the Democrats to do, what the Democrats could do to redeem themselves so much in my eyes, is the Constitution specifically does not specify that the Speaker of the House must be a representative, that the Speaker of the House can just be anyone. So if the Democratic Party was just like, okay, we can't find anyone within our representatives to challenge Nancy Pelosi, but we're going to pull from somebody outside and we're going to elect them Speaker of the House. That would never happen, and I don't believe that's ever happened.
Speaker of the House.
That would be beautiful, just incredible. But no, my point here is that. We still have to be concerned about material benefit in the meantime. And Nancy Pelosi has called universal healthcare a pipe dream before. And I don't know. It's just one of those things that I see a lot of thought out in leftist politics of, where it's like, well, who cares? They're all capitalists. They're all supporting the capitalist state. Who cares? And it's like, well, we still gotta care.
Having these figures up there spreading more left-wing ideals, you know, AOC, you can debate whether she's a democratic socialist or a sock dem. You know, some people think that she's a crypto, you know, dem sock, democratic socialist, which maybe, you know, but just having people up there, having people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, having people like Bernie Sanders, even if they're not perfect, even if they still, you know, endorse capitalism, even if they have shitty takes on Israel or on, you know, or on other issues, even if they have occasional bad takes, simply having people up there who are willing to challenge the status quo matters. Getting these people's names in headlines, getting their ideas out there in articles, having them make proposals and make this, you know, you have to win socialists in order to make any progress at all, socialists have to make progress in the culture war. We have to make inroads into the public consciousness and make our ideas a part of the mainstream discourse, or else we're just not going to be able to, we're not going to be able to grow the party. We're not going to be able to grow the left as an institution, and we're not going to be able to gain political power or, you know, make people organize. Seeing someone who has political power, even if it's as little political power as a single congressperson has, having people with political power go up there and advocate for socialist policies, or at least more progressive policies, does have an effect. It does shift the Overton window. It does change the conversation and make these a part of mainstream discourse. We would not be talking about Medicare for All or universal healthcare at all right now, were it not for Bernie Sanders in his 2016 election run. You know, we need to have people out there who are willing to fight for these ideas and make them heard. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to build leftist power in this country at this point. Because, you know, I'll tell you what, the unions aren't doing so hot right now. And the largest leftist organization in the country, DSA, only has 52,000 members, which is fewer people than there are in my small satellite city of LA. We need to do better. We need to get the word out. And that means that we need people like AOC and we need people like Bernie Sanders, even if they're not perfect.
I will, however, say that Bernie Sanders, I'm trying to pull up the article right now, but...
He did say something really bad recently.
Let me pull it up. I've got it over here. Let's see. There's the royal family being heckled in Ireland. Remember, good. Folks, no more nobles, no more monarchs, no more kings, no more queens, only the workers. Where did it go? Come on. Shows you how much of a professional production I put on over here. Fine, I'll just search Bernie Sanders. Oh, there we go. Can't believe I forgot about this. So, Bernie Sanders, per the World Socialist website, a fascinating name for a website, apparently published by the International Committee of the Fourth International. So, fascinating. Anyways, they have an interview here on CNN wherein Bernie Sanders is being asked if the migrants that are at the border right now fleeing, you know, the hellscape of a country that they came from because of constant regime toppling by certain northern neighbors, or one in particular, if they had a credible claim to asylum. And he said, no, not all the migrants have a credible claim to asylum, and basically extended the olive branch of peace to these anti-immigration proto-fash that are like good and supportive of people shooting tear gas at children and families. Those are the sort of people that he's extending the olive branch out to, are the people that are cheering that we tear gassed a mother and I believe caused one of them to suffocate. Like, I remember seeing that, though I haven't seen it again, so I don't know if that was a sensationalist piece or if the media is just seriously suppressing it. I wouldn't be surprised if the media is suppressing this, because the media has a tendency to suppress things like this very heavily. Like, I mean, this is the thing. We fired fucking tear gas over the border into another country. So you want to fucking talk about sovereignty? You want to talk about borders and nation states? You know what would happen if Mexico fired stuff over the border? We'd probably march to Mexico City already. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Sovereignty only counts when it's us. And that is the epitome of nationalism. And it is why nationalism always leads to this fascist thought.
Yeah. So that's a really bad take by Bernie. That's, you know, I saw that earlier and I was like, really? You know, so the thing with him is he's being pressured extremely hard by Democratic leadership right now to fall in line. I don't know if he's making this sort of concession because of that, or if he's just not, if he just doesn't give a crap, just doesn't give a crap about the migrants. I'm not sure which it is, but that's the thing, is we can't expect these, you know, political representatives like Bernie, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we can't expect them to be our ideological leaders. They aren't the people who are going to lead us in a more progressive direction. They're going, you know, the people who are already on the left, the reason that they're important is because they drag the general public, which is on the whole still extremely reactionary and extremely liberal, is they're still to the left of the general public, and they can still shift people further to our side so that they can hear it. I don't know, criticize me for being, you know, mildly pro-electoralism or whatever if you like, but I think it's, you know, even though Bernie and AOC have crappy takes on the migrant caravan or on Israel-Palestine or whatever else, I still think that that sort of presence in the mainstream political sphere, I think that's still important. Speaking of Israel-Palestine, here's a bit of a story about that that just popped up today with Mark Lamont, or Mark Lamont Hill. So I'm not sure if you heard about this, Alex, but basically, CNN contributor Mark Lamont Hill is a longtime contributor to CNN. He's a media studies professor at Temple University. He made a speech at the UN, I believe it was earlier today, where he criticized Israel and advocated for Palestinian freedom and, the ability, he essentially called for a one-state solution where, Jews and Palestinians can live together in the land of Israel or Palestine or whatever you want to call it, in a single state, and they would all be equally franchised and they would all be able to participate in a democratic society. He essentially called for a peaceful single-state solution. However, in the process of that, he said he wanted a free Palestine from the river to the sea. Well, apparently that phrasing drew the ire of every single pro-Israel group in the world. Every single one essentially called for his head, because apparently Hamas has used that phrasing, stating that they want a liberated Palestinian state cleansed of Jews to exist from the river to the sea. So because he used this language, they're saying that Mark Lamont Hill was dog whistling, you know, his support for the elimination of the Jewish people and the elimination of the Israeli state, and that he's an anti-Semite, and that he's a horrible monster, and he might as well be a Nazi because he supports Palestinian, you know, freedom and voting rights and equal rights in all ways and the end of settler colonialism. And, the pressure went from 0 to 11, and this afternoon, CNN fired Mark Lamont Hill under pressure from AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, and other Israeli interest groups.
Well, moving on from this, and we'll see, listeners, if you're listening to this, whether or not how I decided to cut this apart. But let us have a quick transitional topic to come as a palate cleanser for this failure of society in general. That I'm reading an article here that water is wet and the VA can't fulfill veterans benefits again. And it seems to be a thing that it looks like Paul Warntz, who is the administrator of the VA, came under fire from Congress, that he got pretty sharply criticized at the congressional meeting. And Nancy Pelosi, again, fumed to be Speaker of the House, went after this guy and said he had gross negligence and a shameful lack of accountability. Of course, the most recent thing in the news is that the VA has dropped the ball on the GI Bill. So actually, one of the folks in our central committee, not him, but his significant other, has been having trouble with the GI Bill, and that's causing them some financial hardship. And this is something going on across the nation, that the VA just didn't process the GI Bills. And people who, you know, are trying to exercise that benefit and go to school aren't getting money. And it's not an insubstantial amount of money to just have vanish into thin air, especially when a lot of folks are you know, take advantage of the program to go to school full time after they get out of their contract and don't have another job in place or something. And, you know, it's one of those things like people know my thoughts on, you know, the situation of veterans that I do not buy into one bit the leftist adventurism that we seem to have of where, you know, people just shit can veterans because, or don't you know that America is an imperialist state and anyone who goes in to do that is just obviously baby killer. And it's like, well, fantastic. That's just an excellent take you got there. Please keep it to yourself. But it's one of those situations. This is one of the reasons people go into the military is paycheck and just really good benefits if they would actually give those benefits. And this is the thing that, like, Nancy Pelosi is up there criticizing this guy. And I don't know, Paul Lawrence, I have no idea who this guy is. I don't keep up with every middle-level bureaucrat that exists because you'd go mad if you tried to do that. The government is just too vast for you to keep track of all these people. But I do know for sure that even as the Democrats continue to vote for greater and greater Department of Defense budgets, that's not going to the VA. That's going to money pits like the F-35, which crashed in midair in front of everyone. The plane can't even fly properly. It can't even do the one thing a plane's supposed to do. And we've sunk trillions into it. Just massive amount of money. And where could all those trillions have gone instead of a failed weapons platform that can't even do the job of spreading imperialism, as it were, across the globe? Maybe you could have put it in some veterans benefits so that, you know, a bunch of working class enlisted folk who got done with their contract and got out of the military could actually go and get the benefits that they are promised for selling their soul for 4 to 8 years. But, what do I know?
Yeah, I don't really have a comment on that. You said everything that I would have said. I'm not in that space, so.
Alas, listeners, sometimes I just get too ahead of myself and shut down the conversation before it even begins. Well, there is something else that is in the news that will be something to keep an eye on. That's, you know, actually part of the, you know, the name of this podcast. That we have a Supreme Court case to keep our eyes on now that some individuals from D.C. apparently went to Texas to try to buy a handgun. And federal law prohibits you from buying handguns out of state, that you need to buy your guns in state. There are certain exceptions for, like, neighboring states for private party transfers and stuff. But even for FFLs, even for licensed gun ranges and gun stores, you can't go out of state and go somewhere to grab it. And these guys are making an interesting case. Of course, they're reactionary types, but what else can you expect when it comes to these things? But they're making an interesting argument here. So apparently Washington, D.C. only has one gun store that accepts out-of-state FFL transfers. So there's literally one place to go to if you're in Washington, D.C., if you live in Washington, D.C., which, remember, it's its own jurisdiction. It's its own independent legal body. So it's governed by the same thing as if you were going to another state by leaving D.C. So you have to stay in that one city, that one little territory that's been carved out for the Capitol under this. And so there's only one gun store that does out-of-state FFL transfers. And apparently they charge $115 minimum to process an out-of-state transfer. So their argument is this is an extortion racket. That not only is it an infringement upon their Second Amendment rights, but this is just a straight-up government racket to basically funnel it into exactly these situations where you only have one store that will do it, and that one store profits immensely off of it. And especially in a place like Washington, D.C., where the Washington, D.C. cops are just crazy about you know, crazy about gun seizures and searching people for illegal guns and just constant stop and frisks of predominantly black men walking down the street. I mean, it's to the point where it's just a daily thing, like where it's almost a joke in the community now that when the police drive by, they lift up their shirts so that they can see that they don't got a gun stuffed in their pants. And anyways, it's gone before the Supreme Court now that apparently they appealed it and they passed the district court, but then the circuit court turned it down on a panel, and then the circuit court barely turned it down again. It was like an 8-7 in the circuit court of turning it down and saying, no, the Washington, D.C., or the federal government gets to impose that rule. But the Supreme Court has agreed to hear it. They're also making the argument that background checks have improved, that this is a law back from the 1960s before the instantaneous national background check, and so that there is no real valid reason for the government to place this restriction on people because you're going past the same background check no matter where you are, which, yes and no, because it's only pulling off the federal system, whereas in Washington, D.C., my understanding is that you get searched for the local records as well. So like here in Kansas, you don't have local records searched, to the best of my knowledge, unless you apply for a concealed carry permit. If you're just going to the store and you buy a gun, then you're just getting the federal background check, which is not complete. I mean, obviously, we've had people who have been able to circumvent the system, who just never had their disqualifying events added to the system. I mean, there was that one Air Force guy who got dishonorably discharged, and then he went out and shot some people, and that was never put on the national background check. So there's some merit to what they're saying. At the same time, I wouldn't hinge the entire argument on it. But
that's basically hinging your argument that the government can't allow the civil right because the government is doing a bad job at ensuring that it's done responsibly. They're basically saying that because we're bad at our job, we can't let you have your Second Amendment rights in this case. And it's going to be interesting to see how this goes. I think it's probably going to end up going in favor of gun rights. You know, Roberts might decide to be contrarian for the sake of it because he's old as hell and he has nothing to lose. Kavanaugh is an awful person and I hope he dies a horrible death. But he will probably vote in favor of gun rights. So, you know, if we're going to be living in this Trumpian hellscape, at the very least, they're going to let us own the guns so that we can survive this, you know, Mad Max world. It's, you know, this is the sort of thing, you know, red tape bureaucracy that a lot of blue states like to impose, where it's not really about making sure that guns stay out of the hands of dangerous people. It's about making sure that guns stay out of the hands of as many people as possible, on the theory that by just reducing the number of guns in circulation, that will lead to a decrease in gun violence, which will mean a decrease in overall death and mayhem. This is a theory that's been prominent since the 80s, and it has yet to yield any results. I hate to use conservative rhetoric on this, but, you know, there are a lot of liberal cities with very tight gun laws that have huge amounts of gun crime, that have huge amounts of non-gun crime violence. And these sorts of initiatives to just reduce the total number of guns have so far been completely ineffective. There's no indication that these laws have had any significant impact on ending gun violence in America, and all they do is inconvenience legal gun owners while, you know, also enabling for, as you mentioned, the sort of racist stop and frisk violation of black people's rights and, you know, Latina people. And, you know, it's just trying to use the institutions of a racist bourgeois state to reduce violence is never, ever, ever going to work. You have to tackle these things from the source. You have to go after the socioeconomic conditions that lead to violence. And that means that you need to, you know, lift people up economically. You need to give them good wages. You need to give them, you know, you know, upward mobility in their community is you need to give them, you know, an ownership stake in their community, you know, make people invested in improving their community and give them the tools to do so and stop, you know, funding gentrification and allowing this to, you know, progress where people are forced out of their homes by rising rent prices, you know, so that more white people can move in and build more Starbucks and more Applebee's and whatever the hell else. You can't
Applebee's solve. Actually an actual restaurant. Like, I don't believe in Applebee's. I think it's just actually secretly portals to hell.
You know, every Applebee's
not to derail from this serious topic, but you know,
every Applebee's I've ever been in has looked exactly the same, except for which sports teams they have up on the wall. So you might be onto something there. It might just be an interdimensional portal to one single, you know, platonic ideal of Applebee's somewhere in the bowels of hell. But regardless, you know, I'm sort of optimistic about this court case. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, hopefully this will get overturned and we'll, you know, the people of DC will have more opportunity to arm themselves for defense without having to rely on the racist cops. Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yep, we shall see. And for your moment of zen, listeners, the New York State Senate announced that there's folks in it that announced a bill that will allow the police, or not allow, but, you know, mandate that if you're going to buy a gun, that you turn over your social media accounts and their passwords to the police so that they can log into your account and see what you've been posting and messaging about. And of course, this could never be abused in any kind of way and would definitely not be an infringement upon your First, Second, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights. But, you know.
This is the sort of thing where, okay, so obviously, this is going to be used for political repression. It'll probably be used for repression against the far right, which is probably a good thing. But it's also going to be used against the left. If you've made a guillotine meme, if you've posted around pictures of Gritty with an AK or some crap like that, you know, that's probably going to be used against you as an excuse to strip you of your Second Amendment rights. I guarantee you it's going to be used against, quote, black identity extremists. It's going to be used against people who are critical of Israel. It's going to be used against everyone who isn't an upper middle class petty bourgeois liberal. It's going to be used against anyone who doesn't match the political ideas of the ruling party. But even more than that, I think it's also going to be disenfranchising against people who don't use social media. Like, I don't use social media for personal accounts. There was a point when I used Reddit as a personal social media account, and I guess I still technically have that. But for the most part, I don't use social media in a personal way. I don't have a Facebook. You know, I don't have an Instagram. I don't use these platforms because I don't like the data collection. I don't like the culture on these sorts of platforms. You know, I don't want to participate in that. So what happens if I go to buy a handgun in New York and they say, turn over your social media, you know, turn over your Facebook? And I say, I don't have a Facebook. And they say, we don't believe you, you're lying, therefore we're not going to allow you to purchase a handgun.
Honestly, like, surprises me nothing in that way, because, like, this is something that's been creeping on society for a while now, since the advent of social media. That, like, I've known people, like, seniors that have gone out and graduated out of university, engineering students, who have gone and interviewed at major engineering firms and companies. And literally a question now is, what's your social media accounts? And I've known people who have no interest in social media. Just, it isn't for them. It's not how they consume their news. They don't like the constant buzz and drone of it. And so they just don't do it. And they say that. And it's literally to the point where they basically had to create a social media presence, because interviewers kept turning them down because they see a lack of social media as meaning you are malfunctioning and not integrating into society correctly. And what if you're actually secretly trying to hide something? And it was literally the point where it was killing their job prospects because they don't have a social media. And this is just one of those pervading creeps of where people are forced into this system, which, of course, then feeds into the dozens and dozens of algorithms that power all sorts of things on the internet that are constantly analyzing what you're doing, and can be, that data can be used for anything, be it corporate profit or state repression.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's going to get to the point where it's mandatory, where you have to have a visible social media history in order to be considered a member of society. And it's, I think that that's going to be really destructive, that we're going to end up, you know, forcing people into these platforms. You're essentially being forced to purchase a commercial product, you know, even though you're not purchasing with money, you're still investing time in it. You're giving these people your data. You're giving these people, you know, these companies, rather, you're giving companies like Google and Facebook, you're giving them access to data so they can build models of your life, so that they can target ads at you, just so that you can have the ability to get a job, just so that you can have the ability to, you know, be a functioning member of society. And it's this sort of merger of corporate and state interest, where these sorts of things, even if it isn't by law, these sorts of things become socially mandatory, you know. And God, how do I put this? It's just we're being pushed towards a future that I don't want to live in, you know? Social media, you know, I interact with social media on a purely organizational basis for the SRA at this point. I do very little social media, you know, for my own entertainment or edification or whatever. I really see it as a destructive force in our society. It can be useful in some ways for organizing, for spreading news, but, you know, social media interaction, I think, is really corrosive to a person's mental health. I think it's really corrosive to discourse. I think it's really, you know, I just think that it's, I think that it does bad things to our brain and bad things to our society. And I really hate to see the sort of, you know, making this mandatory participation in this online sphere just to be able to purchase a gun or get a job, or hell, maybe even to rent an apartment at some point in the future. Oh, we need to check your social media to make sure you don't do anything we don't like, which of course just leads to people creating curated social media accounts to create a false image of themselves, essentially leading double lives, putting people in a closet over their behavior, you know, instead of being for homosexuality or for gender or whatever, just, you know, being in the closet about smoking weed or being in the closet about your politics, you know, and having to fake it. And I think that's extremely destructive. I think that's corrosive to the human soul. You know, obviously I'm a materialist. I don't believe in souls, but it's bad. It's just bad. And I really, really don't like the direction that things are heading. And I think there's going to be some more bad news of this sort that we'll probably be talking about on future podcasts. I expect this to come up again.
Absolutely. Well, do you want something to lighten up the mood and bring a smile to your face of somebody else having bad news happen to them? That as we were doing this podcast, I've been live delivered by a frequent listener another story that we have missed about Elon Musk. Yes, listeners, two Elon Musk segments in the same show. This was just delivered to me that just as, you know, he's fighting with the Los Angeles City Council or whatever to dig tunnels underneath Faye's house, he has received a public rebuke today by the NASA administrator, a Mr. Jim Bridenstine. So today, Mr. Bridenstine was out talking to the press, and he said that in context when he was asked by reporters about Elon Musk taking a smoke of weed on the Joe Rogan show and chasing it down with some whiskey, Mr. Bridenstine said, "I will tell you that was not helpful, and that did not inspire confidence." And the leaders of these organizations need to take that as an example of what to do when you lead an organization that's going to launch American astronauts. So I think he had a run-on sentence in there, or otherwise this article kind of cut that out, because he kind of switches midway and says, take that as an example. So it's kind of reading like he wants more people to do weed and smoke whiskey, but I got that backwards.
keep that in there.
Anyways, So, yeah.
Smoke all NASA, the whiskey.
Yes. Anyways, NASA does not approve, apparently, of Elon Musk's drug habits and does not approve, basically, and has ordered a extensive review. Apparently, NASA earlier this month, so that's already happened, but you know, they were talking about it today, that NASA has ordered a review of workplace culture at SpaceX and Boeing, and basically wrote a letter to the board of directors at SpaceX telling them that maybe your employees shouldn't be going on live streams and being intoxicated while representing the company in an official role. So there's definitely rules about those sorts of things, and being a government contractor, NASA has a little bit more sway over SpaceX due to the fact that they can, in fact, cut those contracts, and there are other rocket companies really itching to get some of that coveted NASA bucks. Even though NASA doesn't have nearly as many bucks as they used to, it's still a lot of money on the
line
here.
It's lucrative. And, you know, it's sort of, on one hand, it's bullshit, because Elon Musk, you know, Elon Musk taking a few puffs on the Joe Rogan show doesn't really have any implication for the actual, you know, performance of Tesla's employees. I'm sure that their engineers do a good job, you know, but it's the sort of thing where, you know, Elon Musk or even the engineering team, you know, smoking a little weed now and then isn't necessarily going to cause any real degradation in the performance of their rockets. Presumably they're sober while actually doing important work rather than socializing with enlightened centrist podcasters like ourselves, of course. You know, I think something that's much more likely to have a negative impact on the performance of Tesla's rockets and is more likely to cause an accident that might kill an astronaut is the fact that Elon Musk pressures his employees to put in 80-hour weeks and pushes his employees to the point where they have a massive turnover rate, where people get have mental breakdowns, suffer from physical ailments from, you know, putting all this time, people are sacrificing their health and their sanity to get this work done for Elon Musk, you know, often working unpaid overtime to help him get his shit in on schedule. And, you know, I think that sort of culture is a lot more likely to have negative, you know, that's a lot more likely to cause mistakes and errors and oversights than someone smoking some weed on their own time, or the freaking, you know, celebrity CEO, you know, burning one down on a podcast. But on the other hand, I mean, this couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Let's be honest. Anything of this sort that happens to Elon Musk is thoroughly deserved, just for him being an awful human being. So even though I disagree with the sort of prudish, fuddy-duddy sort of stance that NASA takes towards weed, I'm glad if anyone's going to suffer the brunt of it, it's Elon Musk and his company, because, you know, I don't want to say I'm rooting for his failure, but I'm definitely rooting for him to have a bad time.
Yeah, yeah. So we will see what the adventures of Elon Musk bring next, but we will move towards the conclusion of this episode, that as I prepare to maybe smoke some whiskey myself and go to sleep, we will conclude with the final story of the night. But before then, a message to our sponsors. You are the sponsors, listeners. Just by sheer listening to this, it provides the podcast with a platform to you know, spread the leftist word across the globe. We are international. I have a surprising amount of international listeners. I don't remember the exact statistics. I think Germany is pretty high up there. Canada is pretty high up there. It's actually kind of interesting. Yeah, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, Norway, Vietnam. I have a few listeners in Vietnam. Really fascinating global stuff where you can start breaking down the statistics on. But if you want to contribute more than just your, you know, time listening to me and Faye drivel on about these things, there is an option to support the podcast at patreon.com/socialistrapodcast. Here you can sign up for $5 a month and gain access to some exclusive content that is put out less regularly than I like it to be. But, you know, it's been a crazy month. And these things include, you know, special episodes. I do still have some interviews planned, and I'll probably put some of those up behind the Patreon, at least for a little bit, have an exclusivity period, and then release it to the general public. As well as every now and then I'll write an essay and throw it up there. And, you know, it provides you with the warm, fuzzy sensation that you bought me five boxes of spaghetti. Or as I've more recently begun adapting to, I've started buying 2 jars of peanut butter, which can also be bought for $5 and is much more rich in protein.
Look at Mr. High Roller here.
I know. That peanut butter is just delicious. So if you want to further the cause of me buying 2 jars of peanut butter with your hard-earned labor vouchers, you too can go to patreon.com/socialistrapodcast and begin tossing those in on a monthly basis. So let us conclude this episode with a brief mention to some maybe not great cyberpunk technology, or at least the beginnings of it. Microsoft has won a $500 million military contract that will have it adapt its HoloLens augmented reality technology to the battlefield so that soldiers have AR displays and can see their biometrics and can have target acquisition and just all the fun things of making real-life combat more into a Call of Duty game.
Yeah, this is the sort of thing where, you know, this is the sort of thing where we're sort of gamifying the battlefield. This is a process that's been going on for a while. You know, this was a story that was big back during the Obama years and sort of faded away. The American drone pilots who are dropping bombs on, you know, maybe possibly terrorists, or more likely probably just random, you know, brown people in the Middle East, these drones are often piloted using Xbox controllers. And so you have this sort of alienation from the actual harm being caused by this warfare. And you have these people, you know, basically watching a screen using a video game controller to fly this drone and drop deadly ordnance on people halfway across the world. And it's gamifying the experience and making it's distancing people from the reality of combat and the reality of the horror that they're visiting on other human beings. And this is a progress. This is a process that's been going on for a while. And additionally, the U.S. military has been specifically targeting video gamers for recruitment. There's a reason that you know, all these military first-person shooter video games, these companies all have advisors from the actual military, Call of Duty especially, and Battlefield, although maybe not the more recent ones, because that they've been going back to World War One and World War Two rather than modern combat theaters. But companies have been advised in their games by the U.S. military. They've in some cases been sponsored by the U.S. military. They've been encouraged to put pro-U.S. themes in their game, you know, and especially during the earlier parts of the War on Terror, it was encouraged to have video games where the enemies are, you know, Russians or Arabs or, you know, Muslim, so that they can start this process of dehumanization while people are still young. And then when they turn 18 and they're eligible for recruitment, you know, they've been exposed to this ideology. They've been exposed to this gamified experience of shooting different colored people, you know, on a screen, and then recruiting them because they've already been inculcated with this ideology, because they've already been used to, you know, shooting people in the virtual world. I guess theoretically that makes it easier for them to shoot people in real life. And now that we're getting these AR displays where we're going to have, you know, basically a heads-up display in front of soldiers' eyes, possibly highlighting targets, you know, displaying orders, but like it's freaking Halo or something. I don't even know how to describe it, but it's gamifying warfare, essentially, and removing the reality from it and making it easier for soldiers to distance themselves from it. And, you know, this sort of, you know, augmented reality thing, it doesn't seem too insidious, but this is just the start of it, especially considering the sort of cyber, you know, like actual physical enhancement that the U.S., and Europe and Israel have been putting into developing actual combat, physical combat enhancements for soldiers. I think Alex knows a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, suffice to say, people in positions of authority and power within the military of multiple countries really want augmented soldiers. I mean, this is just the point where we are in technology. I mean, the biggest thing holding things back right now at this point isn't like even like strapping people into, you know, exosuits and slapping armor on them. The biggest thing right now is power sources. There's no good power sources. Every other problem has basically been surmounted. It's just a matter of how do you actually power these things? And eventually we're going to find a breakthrough on that. Eventually we'll find a better way of producing power in the limited space that you have. And then, yeah, I mean, this is the first step, and this is just one piece of a total component that is the future of warfare. And it's a cyberpunk future, is all I can say. It's going to be crazy. And you know what? Look here in America, and look at how much the police force gets old surplus military tech, and not even old tech, but like just stuff decades out. Not even a decade. Like there's police departments getting stuff from the Iraq War that's being pushed as surplus. So how long until surplus heads up displays get pushed to police departments? How long before police departments are using this? And I'll say not very long, because police departments are already trying to do stuff like this. If you think the cyberpunk dystopia is just a fantasy or it's years off, think again. Even here in Wichita, Kansas, not really, you know, a place where you're expecting cutting edge technological pursuits by our city government, but we've been experimenting on our downtown for a while now of a unified camera system. They had all the business owners downtown sign an agreement turning over their CCTV feeds over to the city government, which all goes to a central hub, which is monitored around the clock. And guess what? It hasn't really cut down on crime downtown, but what it has done is now people are getting harassed over petty offenses. Everyone who does a California stop through a stop sign gets ticketed now. Everyone who doesn't use their blinker gets a ticket now. People that are drunk out on the street, they're adding stuff to this, like pseudoscience stuff like gait recognition of seeing if you're drunk or not. And that's not a very good technique. Like, I've read very damning things about anything to do with gait recognition, but it's the thing where you stumble out of the bar and the computer thinks you're too drunk for your own good, so it dispatches a police officer to go deal with you. And it's literally trial run. The police have talked about getting drones. Then they've asked the city before about like putting money in the budget for drone operators to have drones flying around that are connected into the system so that it can follow people around that it labels persons of interest, which, by the way, they've also incorporated face recognition into this. And Wichita has a very serious problem with having everyone on the gang list. Like, at one point, I believe 5% of the city population was put on the gangs registry with the police department. There's just so many ways for this to be abused. And this is part of where we're going. All of these technological steps are falling into place. And if you don't think that this is going to be used more and more as society does start to have very serious tremors from the fact that the planet is changing around us, and these crises are only going to become more and more apparent and more frequent. The state's going to use all the resources at its disposal to maintain order, or maintain its legitimacy and sovereignty, at least, propping itself up, even if that means chaos for the rest of us. And this is just one way they're going to do it. And it starts with the military, but it will come to civilian police forces as well. And that's honestly the scarier thing, is these police officers driving down the road and their heads-up display, they look at you and suddenly they've got your entire file pulled up. And now they know everything that the government's got on you. So I'm driving down the street and fantastic, their HUD is linked into whatever government database I'm surely on at this point, multiple, I'm sure, and now they can stop and harass me because they don't much like those leftists.
Yep, we, you know, of all the predictions of the future, of all the science fiction authors, it looks like cyberpunk nailed it the best. We're racing towards that future head first, and, you know, we're not getting a lot of the benefits. We've got cool phones, and we've got memes. But beyond that, we're really getting into this sort of techno-futuristic authoritarianism, and, you know, climate change especially is going to contribute to that, as the social and economic disruptions caused by that cause civil unrest, which is going to be responded to by fascism and by criminalization of people of color to an even greater extent, particularly along America's southern border. We're in for some bad times, you know? There's a reason that the Socialist Rifle Association exists, and that's so that people can be prepared in the extreme cases to be able to defend themselves, you know, as well as in the current, you know, our current already extreme situation where we have to worry about mass shooters and we have to worry about neo-Nazis and we have to worry about, you know, harassment and we have to worry about groups like Adam Boffin. You know, I don't want to make things too dark, but these are things that we need to be aware of, that we need to realize are happening right now, and we need to be prepared for the future that is being built, because it's not a leftist one. And at the rate things are going, odds of revolution aren't looking likely.
Pretty much. On that ever optimistic note, we will conclude the podcast and say our farewells. So, as always, I can be reached at Humvadev on Twitter, as well as being basically constantly in the Slack. I've had a couple members comment to me now that I seem to be in the Slack at all times, and it is true. I am omnipresent, constantly watching, constantly vigilant. So you can send me a message there, too. Faye, of course, can be found at LA_socialistRA and picked for her brain on these things. Yeah, keep an eye out for anything maybe special happening with the Marxist Center that I'm going to try to work something out. We'll see if I can't get peoples on to be guests and maybe do a live stream from the center, though I've read the policy and apparently you're not supposed to do live streams. So maybe not live, but live in quotation marks. We'll see. So I'm hopeful that's going to be a fantabulous time, and I think it'll be pretty good for folks involved. It's definitely glad to see a bunch of different leftist groups getting together and being in the same room, at least. It's always good to see leftist unity in that fashion. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and say I'm going to go seize the means of sleep and probably not actually sleep because I gotta go pack. So, good night, listeners.
Solidarity forever.